Good morning to you. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. My name is David Inge. In this part of Focus, we'll be talking with author Bill McKibben about his new book, The Age of Missing Information. And as he explains in his book, he writes, "We believe that we live in an age of information, that there has been an information explosion and information revolution. While in a certain narrow sense this is the case, in many important ways just the opposite is true. We also live at a moment of deep ignorance, when vital knowledge that humans have always possessed about who we are and where we live seems beyond reach, an unenlightenment, an age of missing information." And so he also goes on to explain, in an effort to try to demonstrate this and understand it, he did two things. He looked at the vehicle that delivers to most people most of their information, that is television, and he did it in a big way. He picked a cable system, it happens to be in Fairfax, Virginia, that had a lot of channels. And he had some friends there, and he asked them to tape an entire day's worth of programming. And here we're talking about thousands of hours of programming, which he then, over a period of time, watched. All of it. Everything. Everything that you could see on a day on this cable system. And then he also spent some time outside by himself in the outdoors to get an idea of what you could learn from each of those experiences and to get a better handle on what it is, perhaps, that we have lost because we don't have much contact with nature, or perhaps when we do have contact with nature, it's through nature documentaries that we see on television. And that is his thoughts on those two experiences are contained in the book, The Age of Missing Information. Random House is the publisher, if you'd like to read it. Bill McKibben has written many articles for The New Yorker. His writings on nature have also appeared in The New York Review of Books, in The New York Times, and Rolling Stone. And he's the author of a previous book, which we talked about on this program a couple of years ago, the book entitled The End of Nature, which appeared in 1989. And he's joining us this morning by telephone. And if you would like to talk with us, you should certainly feel free to pick up the telephone and call. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. We also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Mr. McKibben, hello.
Hello there, David. How are you?
I am good. Thank you. Thanks very much for talking with us today.
It's a pleasure.
How is it that this idea, this sort of frightening idea of watching all of this television occurred to you? What started you thinking about it?
Well, you know, I'd written this other book, The End of Nature, which argued in the end that we were going to cope with the kind of global environmental problems that we were facing, that we would need to change many of the ways in which we live our daily lives, many of our habits and routines that sort of make up our economy and our lifestyle. Having said that, I realized that was a lot easier said than done, even for me. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to figure out why we were so rooted in doing things the way we are. I wanted to understand, I guess, what the pictures in my head and other people's heads were. I mean, I was, you know, born in 1960, grew up with the television as a kind of, you know, third parent, and its effect was as profound on me as it was on everybody else in terms of tailoring my attitudes and habits and ideas. And so I sort of started from that environmental bent, but as I kind of was just explaining, it sort of became more than that, a kind of intellectual and generational autobiography in some sense.
Mm-hmm. You explain in the book that at your home there in New York State, you don't watch television.
Well, we can't. We're either geographically disadvantaged or advantaged in that where we live. Without a satellite dish, you can't get TV, and we don't have a satellite dish. We're just too far down in the valley, and there's no cable because there are not that many people around and things. So, for you know, I hadn't watched TV for quite a while before I did this, and I think I make this analogy in the book. It was like coming back to it for this project for a little while to watch all this television, it was like going home on Christmas break after your first semester at college. And all of a sudden, you sort of realized all these things about your mother that you hadn't really noticed in 18 years of living with her all the time, you know. With just a little tiny bit of distance, suddenly you could see things more clearly.
Mm.
That's what it felt like.
How long did it take?
Well, it took the better part of a year, I would say, watching, I don't know, 6 or 7 hours of TV a day, which sounds, you know, I mean, that sounds absurd, sitting and watching 6 or 7 hours of TV a day. And at some level, it is absurd. The scary thing is that in the average American home, the TV is on for between 6 and 7 hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I was watching with a good deal more attention and care than people normally do. But the sheer volume, I mean, what makes television so interesting, so much more interesting, in many ways, I think, than the other arts and things, is just the way in which it's used. It's the first art form that you can use like a utility. I mean, radio to some extent, too, but TV, because you have to sit there and look at it, is much more, you know, takes up much more of your mental energy and time. And it's just like a utility. I mean, I'm sure you know people who turn on the TV the first thing they do when they walk into a room.
Yeah.
I know people who I go over to visit, and the TV stays on while we're talking.
Yeah, and it's a very strange experience to, and I think, you know, I fight my best instincts to try to focus on the person I'm talking to, and yet there's this other sort of noise and distraction going on.
Drifting slowly around.
Yeah, it's yes, I do know.
Well, we've been trained, you know, to think that Jay Leno is a far more interesting person than whoever you might be, you know, sitting and talking with, which in general is not true. I mean, if there's any point to this book, I think, I'm not even sure I sort of make it explicitly in the course of the book, but what I've sort of come to realize from thinking about it is that, you know, TV doesn't exactly rot your mind. I don't feel like my mind is rotted. I think it works fairly well, and so do most of the people I know who grew up with it. What TV does is put your mind on hold, you know, for very long periods of time. Now, while it's on hold, it's whispering a lot of things into your head that probably aren't very good for us, and we can talk about some of those in a little while. But the sort of thing to realize is, more than anything, is just how much of life is postponed while we sit and watch television.
Mm.
It's, you know, that kind of voice, I think, that people hear after 2 or 3 hours of watching prime time on an evening. The voice that's saying, I really could be doing something more interesting than this, you know. I think that sort of voice from the back of your head is the kind of voice of this generation.
Let's talk about the other side of this project. For your balance to this kind of information, you just sort of set out and spent a few days, a couple of days on your own, sleeping out, you know, in a tent or a sleeping bag or whatever. It's just trying to experience direct as possible.
All the time. And I could as easily have gone to the middle of a city, I think, and spent a lot of time in contact with other human beings. Where I live, it's sort of easiest to go into the outdoors. What I wanted was a kind of baseline of real reality to make it easier to think about the kind of art. Because, you know, if you sit and watch TV all the time, after a while it begins to seem, it does begin to seem like that's the real world, you know. And you begin to have sort of, you know, strange phenomenon like Dan Quayle, deciding that Murphy Brown must be a real person and making real decisions. Or you turn on, as I did a few weeks ago in a hotel room right before Mother's Day, turned on Joan Rivers, and she was interviewing Florence Henderson, Mrs. Brady, and Shirley Jones, Mrs. Partridge of the Partridge family, to learn about mothering, you know. You begin to, I mean, the sort of boundaries between the real world and the, 17-inch Trinitron world begin to blur a little bit.
Yeah. It's the Brady Bunch seems to come up a lot in your discussion of television, but only, I think, for good reason, because, and I suppose you only realize it once you start asking people and people start talking about it, how profoundly for those people who grew up and would have been kids at that time, you know, in the post 50s generation, how strongly in their minds that seems to represent family and what the family was supposed to be like.
Normalcy, and the thing is to remember that it's not just that generation. I mean, I happened to be watching it the first time it was, you know, when it was on the first go-round, when it was on Friday nights on ABC, directly before the Partridge Family in room 222, if I remember correctly. But it's now on. You can now watch it. You could basically go all day if you had a big enough cable system watching nothing but the Brady Bunch. I mean, it's on constantly, and it remains incredibly popular. MTV did a survey of kids, high school and college kids, and their favorite program remained the Brady Bunch, even though it's been, you know, it went off the air originally when they were 4 or 5 years old.
One of the things that you talk about in the book, I think it's an interesting idea, interesting to think about, is that one of the things television has done is to create a sort of a feeling that there really wasn't anything before television.
Yeah.
And that, of course, because I suppose that's because the thing that television is most about is television.
Right.
It's about itself.
We think of television as technologically really powerful, but it's incredibly technologically limited. I mean, it can only deal with things for which it has pictures, and which basically means the last 40 years, you know. If you want to go back before that, you have to do what you did in the Civil Wars, you know, and, you know, make a motion picture of a still photograph or a drawing or something, and that doesn't happen very often. So basically, we just marinate over and over and over again in the history of the last 40 years. And we know it incredibly well in a kind of nuanced fashion, so we can, you know, easily pick out what decade something's from and so on and so forth. And we're very comfortable with all of that. It doesn't feel odd to us to look back at, you know, Mary Tyler Moore show or the Dick Van Dyke show before that. You know, they all seem kind of part of... The problem with that... One of the problems with that, and this is, I'll shift here to the practical for a minute, speaking purely from an environmental point of view, the last 40 years is a tremendous anomaly, you know, in human history. The ways in which we've consumed, it's a kind of, you know, it's a kind of drunk in a more sober course of history. And to the extent that we think of that as completely normal, and just the way life is, that's going to be troublesome. I mean, most of us can't afford to live like the Brady Bunch, you know. I don't know many people who are planning to raise 6 children and maintain a maid, you know, on 1 income. But we can't even go on sort of aiming for that because it's clearly, I mean, even if we could do it in this country, we clearly can't do it around the world. If there's going to be 8 billion people on this planet soon, you just can't go organize them into 1 billion Brady Bunches. You know, any attempt to live at that kind of level of consumption will be environmentally devastating, and yet that's what we aim for. I mean, our leading export now, right up there with aircraft, either 1 or 2, is movies and television programs. That is, our major export is our vision of the good life. And it's pretty dangerous to be, I think that this is a lot, it's sort of underneath a lot of what was going on in Rio last week.
Our guest this morning is Bill McKibben. He is a writer, and we're talking about his recent book, The Age of Missing Information. If you have questions, comments, want to be a part of the conversation, you can call in 333-WILL. That's our local number. We also have a toll-free line, and that's 800-222-WILL. At one point, you write, and you're talking about television, and you say, you write, "I don't fret about TV because it's decadent or shortens your attention span or leads to murder. It worries me because it alters perception. TV and the culture it anchors masks and drowns out the subtle and vital information contact with the real world, that the real world once provided. And I wonder if you could talk about some of those things. I mean, what are the things that we used to know don't anymore?
Let's take a few examples going from the small and practical to the enormous and transcendent. Where I live in a very backward part of the world. That is, I live in a place where it was only a generation or so ago that people really knew how to take care of themselves, were enormously skilled, had immense amounts of information across a wide spectrum of things, unlike most of us who tend to be very skilled in one particular thing and, you know, use that skill to get money to hire other people who are particularly skilled in whatever their particular thing is. Anyway, I was sitting with a neighbor friend of mine, an old man up in the mountains where I live, and we were sitting on a big piece of stone in front of the church. And we got talking about it, and it turned out he had helped cut it, 70 years ago, this big slab of granite. So he went into a long discussion of how you cut granite, which was interesting, and certainly a skill that I would never have developed. But as I was sitting there listening, I mean, it occurred to me that I didn't really need to know how to cut granite either, and never would. But what was so interesting was realizing that the real piece of information that this man had that I didn't have was how to organize your friends and neighbors to get something done. He had a tremendous amount of civic and political skill, social skill, as anyone would have who lived not very long ago in real contact with other human beings. I mean, if you were going to farm, you had to have a barn, and a barn is too big to put up by yourself, so you had to make sure that you knew how to get all your neighbors to come help you and to create the kind of communities where that was possible. Someone did a survey last year and found that 70% of Americans were not on familiar terms with their next-door neighbors. I mean, that's just a kind of recipe and definition of political powerlessness, and it's no wonder to me that we feel as powerless as we do. So there's one sort of very pragmatic thing. On a different level, let's say you're outside, camped in the woods, and at night the sun goes down and out come the stars. Well, the human reaction to sort of being out under the stars has largely been the same throughout history, and it's been profound. You feel kind of small, not in a bad way necessarily or even probably. You feel a kind of small part of something very large, very harmonious, very awesome. And that's a good, I think, that being put in perspective is enormously useful for all sorts of things. We don't spend very many nights out looking at the stars anymore. We're inside, watching the other kind of stars that are on television. And there the message is just the opposite. It's that you're the most important thing on the planet, This bud's for you. We do it your way. We do it all for you. The obsequious, flattering nature of television. Mm-hmm. And that's in the end quite dangerous. I mean, it encourages us in the delusion that we really are at the center of things and that we can get away with behaving as if we were, which environmentally and socially and everything else is very dangerous. I mean, it's a new development in the kind of advanced consumer society of which TV is the most important part, this idea that individual human beings are and their desires are all important. Human beings have, under the influence of, largely under the influence of nature, I think, have tended to put God or nature or some amalgam of those and the tribe, at the center of things. But we can't tolerate that in a consumer society. It might put certain limits on the ways in which we, acquire and spend and whatever, that might be damaging to the consumer society. And so therefore there's this endless and ultimately, I think, very dangerous and very soul-deadening concentration on individual desire. Mm-hmm. There's across a wide range, there are a couple of answers.
Well, I have a couple of people who would like to be a part of the conversation, so
terrific.
Let's do that. We'll start with line number one. Hello.
Hello. I have one very simple comment, one very simple question for your guest. I'm enjoying this very much, and he's kind of bringing forth ideas that I've kind of unconsciously, you know, had for a long time. The question is, where in New York State do you live?
Up in the Adirondack Mountains, the last great wilderness in the eastern United States.
Well, I'm from New York myself originally, and two summers ago I hiked the Northville Placid Trail. So where in the Adirondacks, what town?
Near Gore Mountain. We're not really near too much of a town, but
yeah.
When you hike the Northville Placid Trail, we're about 40 miles east of you, 30 miles east of you.
Well, okay. Thank you very much. That's
all right.
All I had. Great.
Okay, thank you. We have someone else to talk with on our toll-free line. Hello.
I just tuned in a few minutes ago. I may not have correctly understood, but am I right that you think the United States is overpopulated and that overpopulation is threatening the world? Is that right?
I don't recall saying that. It's
something about how people in the United States were using far too many natural resources.
Oh, well, that I did say, yes.
I don't know if this is relevant. Maybe I haven't properly understood you, but the United States is losing population, not gaining population. We're not even sustaining our own rate of population, and most of the civilized world is not. Western Europe certainly is not, and parts of Africa are being depopulated by AIDS. That may be the most unreported major news story of the decade.
Well,
the continent of Africa is being depopulated. The rate of AIDS in Central Africa is from 10 to 30% in some places. Now, that's a perception of true reality. You're trying to get at true reality.
Yeah, this is a little bit off the point here, but I would not want, for my part, for anyone to think that population increase did not continue to be a serious problem in this world. And we're increasing the world population currently at about 95 million people a year. Which is a pretty it's about the population of Mexico or so being added to the globe every year, and the population of the United States every 2.5 years or so. Population increase remains a tremendous problem, and it remains, I believe, a problem here too. The population of the United States continues to go up. In fact, the rate at which it is going up is increasing slightly over the last, in between the last two censuses.
Yeah, but the only reason it goes up is because we have immigrants.
We do have immigration, yes.
That's right. If it weren't for immigrants, we would actually be losing population.
Well, fine. But the one of the things to remember is that that when we talk about population, we tend to think of it as a kind of third world problem, you know. But it's really not necessarily. I mean, an American child, a child born in the average American suburb, if you're worried about environmental damage, say you're worried about CO2 emissions, which I'm worried about, over the course of a lifetime will account for something like 40 times the CO2 emissions of a child born in, say, Central Africa, which means that the environmental problem can be, stated in an equation pretty easily. I mean, the difficulties that we face are the result of multiplying population times rates of consumption times the efficiency with which that consumption is undertaken. I think very much that we need to address all three of those issues. We've begun make halting steps to begin to address efficiency. And electric utilities, say, are getting more efficient than they used to be. Automobiles are getting less efficient, which is a big problem. We haven't begun to do anything seriously about population, which is what I'm not something I'm really talking about in this book. I do talk a lot about consumption in this book, and I think it's another thing that we have to really begin to grapple with. The ideology of endless expansion, endless growth, more is better in terms of consumption is a very troubling thing on what's ultimately a finite earth. And of course, I guess what I'm saying is that the biggest question for the end of the 20th century, at least in the rich countries, is how much is enough? Now, the answer that the television always wants to give you is more would be nice. I mean, it's kind of endless. Everyone knows it. That kind of endless accumulation of or production of desires. But we're reaching a point where it's very hard, if we're thinking rationally instead of emotionally, as commercials encourage us to do, where it's very hard to rationally believe that there's very much to be gained by more material advance. I mean, our lives have already been so streamlined that what is, you know, what are we going to hope for next? When Elroy wants to make dinner on the Jetsons, a very important television program, Elroy walks over to the wall and punches a button and dinner pops out. Well, when you want to make dinner with a prepared entree in a microwave oven, it's essentially the same thing. And we're beginning to realize that, you know, that this is, we don't need more speeding up, more convenience, more comfort, more ease. We want more engagement with tasks around us. We want to make dinner with some skill and some care and share it slowly with family and friends if we can figure out a way to have the time to do that. And that's, you know, that message is not one that ever comes across on television.
May I say to you that I pretty much agree with what you've said. I believe the satisfactions of the soul are far better than material satisfaction, but I am concerned about conservation, and one of the main concerns I have are misleading, extravagant statements, exaggerated projections by so-called conservationists that never come true. And when they don't, it causes people to become suspicious. People become mistrusting, so that when the real environmental crunch comes, and when they're actually telling the truth and we are in trouble, people are not going to be willing to make the proper sacrifices, and then the Earth really will be threatened.
Well, I agree with you there. I think that being absolutely accurate about environmental problems is very important, and that's certainly something I've tried to do. And I think with good, so far, success in my books, my first book was The End of Nature, was kind of the first general book about global warming and the greenhouse effect. And I was very worried when it came out that I would have managed to botch some of the science someplace, but all the scientists who read it were pretty kind, so I was pleased. But I take your point and agree with you.
Well, it's good to talk to you. Good show, David.
Thank you for the call. Well, in this part of Focus 580, our guest is Bill McKibben. He's written many articles for The New Yorker, and his writings on nature have also appeared in a number of other publications. He's the author of a book that came out a couple of years ago called The End of Nature, and his most recent is entitled The Age of Missing Information. Random House is the publisher. And in the book, he makes the argument that while we think that we are living in an era of information explosion, what we have to do is look at that information to which we have access and ask the question, what good is it? Does it really tell us anything? Do we learn anything? And in an effort to try to understand these questions, he did two things. He taped an entire day's, with the help of some people, some friends, he taped an entire day's worth of television on a very large cable system. This happened to be in Fairfax, Virginia. And he got all that tape, and he watched all of the programs that one could watch in an entire day. And then also spent some time, as he frequently does, outside, near the place where he, not far from the place where he lives, I think, in New York State, to get an idea of what you can learn from the two experiences, what you can learn from a day's worth of TV, and what you can learn by spending time outside, in an effort to get at what we have missed because we don't have much direct contact with nature anymore. That, I think, is the essence of The Age of Missing Information. And, of course, so if you'd like to read it, you might take a look at it. It's out in bookstores now. We have some other folks here to talk with, so let's do that, and we'll start with line one. Hello.
Oh, hello. I tuned in partway through the show, and I was interested because of the last caller. And so I'm not really sure where my comment fits in, but I guess I would like to ask your guest what he learned in terms of what we think and how we perceive the problem of garbage in this country. That is, the things we throw away.
Mm-hmm. Well, what's interesting about to me about the problem of garbage, and you sort of see this reflected on television, about the problem of garbage and whatever, is that we're getting pretty good, at least, you know, consciously, about dealing with the end products. You know, people are really beginning to take recycling seriously and whatever. we haven't really begun at all to deal with the kind of larger problem of creating this stuff in the first place. You know, why it is that we're living in such a way that
yeah.
we create immense amounts of trash that needs and one of the one of the reasons is that the things that television is constantly telling us about are precisely the kind. I mean, for instance, the absurd, endless emphasis on convenience for everything. It's just, for instance, there's an ad that was on the day I was watching TV. This will give you a good example of a lot of things that I'm talking about. There's an ad that was on all the time because they were launching a new product. And this new product was called Jet Dry. And you added it, as I recall, to the rinse cycle of your dishwasher after the detergent had done its thing, because the announcer said that there was a chance that your dishwasher was leaving an, quote, invisible residue on your glasses and plates and things. Now, if you stop and really think about it for a little while, I mean, this is absurd. This is, you know, Lady Macbeth kind of stuff. I mean, buying products to remove invisible stains from things. And yet, it's a kind of natural evolution of what, and so, of course, there's whatever is in this Jet Dry is washing into the sewer system, and the jar that it came from is, or box that it came from is ending up in a landfill someplace, and the amount of energy and time and effort that it takes to produce and market and advertise and distribute it, I guess one of the things that just becomes overwhelming if you spend a lot of time really thinking about TV as you watch it, is the almost absurd level of our consumer society at the moment. We have very few wants left to satisfy, and yet we have this enormous want satisfying machine, you know,
yeah.
needs somehow to be fed all the time.
Yeah, I guess I agree. And whereas we do have a people being, you know, concerned about recycling and wanting to do something, I think the general public is pretty sympathetic to that point of view. The manufacturers themselves are off on another planet. They might as well be, because they have done nothing, virtually nothing, to package the things that they do make, so that the packaging at least can be recycled.
Isn't it annoying when you get things that have, you know, foil and cardboard in them or something?
Well, yeah.
What they're going to go into.
And many of us, you know, try to live comparatively simply so that we avoid that sort of thing, but I think that consciousness has not reached the majority of the people, and they are oblivious, and they go and buy the stuff, and they go and throw it away.
Mm-hmm.
Well, anyway, that's, it seems that it's another program, I guess.
In a way it is, but, you know, all these kind of behavioral changes that we know we're going to have to someday make are made harder, much harder, by the fact that every night when we come home and turn on the TV, we're encouraged to live in the fantasy world.
Exactly.
Of we can just go on doing whatever we want.
Exactly.
Encouraged to think that a really good way to live would be to have, you know, a huge house like the Brady Bunch and a maid like Alice and
yes.
do all the work and
yeah,
whatever
yeah.
else.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
thank you.
Should we be writing letters to our congressmen and asking them to introduce legislation that would encourage the manufacturers to change their ways?
Yeah, that's probably a good idea. One good idea, anyway.
Okay. It was good talking with you.
Yes.
Thank you for the call.
Mm-hmm.
Let us go on here. We have somebody on our toll-free line once again.
Yes. Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I just read you a little article here. Kids who have it all appreciate nothing. And the kids that watched television 40 years ago are the people today that have all of these gizmos. And they think there's a new and improved one coming out every other week. So they go down and buy the new and improved one, and the other one goes into the dump, just like this Jet Dry thing you're talking
yes.
about. People can be convinced that black is white if you hammer at them long enough.
I tell you what the great test of this is going to be in the next 5 years. AT&T announced about 2 months ago that they'd finally figured out how to make video phones, and they were going to market them beginning next year, I guess. Now, this is a video phone, a device where when you call up, you have to look at the person you talk to and them at you. This is a device that virtually nobody wants. You know, everyone's first impulse when they hear about it is just to think how horrible it's going to have to be to get up in the morning and put on makeup or, you know, something before you can answer the phone. One of the nice things about the phone is that we can sit here and have this nice conversation, and I can be doing whatever, you know, you can be clipping your toenails, and I can be lying on my back or whatever. I mean, it's kind of nice. But I guarantee you that for the next 5 or 10 years, every night when you turn on TV, America's finest minds are going to be hard at work figuring out just what combination of pictures of grandchildren and puppy dogs and things it'll take to make us all go out and buy something that we don't need, that we don't really want, and that will take the last appliance in the house that doesn't draw any electric current and force you to plug it into a socket and connect it to an electric utility.
You want to hear a good little poem?
Yes.
People go in debt to buy things they don't need and can't afford to impress people they don't like.
There's altogether too much to that, I would say.
That's the truth.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Well, thanks for the call. Other comments or questions are welcome. We have about 10 minutes left. We're talking with author Bill McKibben about some of the things in his book, The Age of Missing Information. So if you'd like to call in, please do. Something that intrigues me that you have written about in the book, certainly one of the things you've written about a lot is people's relationship with nature and their contact with the natural world and how that is diminishing all the time. You've written some very interesting things about television images of nature. And I guess there are probably a lot of people who whose main way of experiencing nature is to see nature documentaries, the stuff that's on public TV and on the Discovery Channel and, those sorts of things.
And it's the most beautiful stuff on television often.
Yeah.
I mean, some of them are wonderfully made. The trouble is that when you spend a lot of time watching them, you begin to get a very distorted idea of what nature is about, it seems to me. I mean, it's sort of as if you drew all your conclusions about human nature from watching, the Perry Mason and Hawaii Five-O and MacGyver and Streets of San Francisco or whatever crime programs you wanted to watch. I mean, basically, animals on nature programs on television fight with each other and have sex. Which are pretty much the same things that people do on television.
Yeah.
I mean, if animals could drive cars, you could have car chases. But as it is, you just have to kind of watch as the cheetah overtakes the gazelle and devours him. This is all interesting and beautiful, but if, having read that, you walk outside your door and into the woodlot in your backyard or into your park or even into a woods like where I live and where I spend a lot of time, you may be disappointed to find that you're not constantly surrounded by a sort of homicidal orgy of wildlife. I mean, one of the characteristics of animals is that they tend to stay away from you. And even if you do see them, I mean, every once in a while I come across a bear in the woods and they usually quickly leave, but if they don't happen to see me and I'm in a distance, they'll be sitting there, you know, doing something like basking in the sun. I guess what I'm trying to say is that if this was your idea of what nature was supposed to be, you would really devalue and not take particularly good care of the real natural world that's around us all the time, and it's full of meaning. You wouldn't listen to the real lessons for us, which have a lot to do, I think, with pace and slowness and sufficiency of the sort that we were talking about before, about how much is enough. I mean, one of the important lessons that you get from spending some time in the natural world is that there is such a thing as maturity, that communities, natural communities, come to a proper size and manage to maintain it. You don't go walking through the woods thinking, boy, they could squeeze in some more trees here, you know. It seems to be enough, to be the right size. And that's a powerful, should be a powerful lesson for us to kind of curb our expansionism some. But if you're just expecting to, and only interested in seeing, you know, wildebeests get eaten by ocelots, then you may not be paying very much attention to this sort of thing.
A couple more people here to talk with. Line one, next. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
On Discovery Channel, there was a series from Australia called Beyond 2000, the science program.
Yes.
And with that, they've had a number of innovative items. One of the most intriguing things I saw was a pair of eyeglasses with microprocessors built into the lenses that were wired down to a belt pack transmitter, which went to a monitor some distance away, so that everything that you were looking at, they could see on the TV screen in three dimensions. And it was supposed to have been in the video stores in another few years. Well, when you consider the lag time between when that appeared on Australia and the number of times it's been repeated on Discovery Channel, I'm just wondering what lag time are they referring to? 1995 or 2015 or...
I don't know. Sometimes these things take a little longer, but I must say, for my part, I'm not going to worry too much about waiting for it. It strikes me that this sounds like a kind of primitive beginning of what people call virtual reality, and the ability to have technologically created spaces. So you put on a helmet or special gloves or things, and you'll be able to kind of move through some artificial space and participate in it. It's something, the appeal of which I've never understood at all. Partly, I guess mostly, because I find real reality incredibly interesting and involving and absorbing, and you don't have to pay, some Japanese conglomerate immense amounts of money in order to participate in it. You can just walk out the door and there it is. I guess this is sort of in line with what I was saying before about this kind of sense that we've done all the interesting things we can do to make life interesting and more enriching technologically. And now we have to figure out the sort of tougher task of how to make it more interesting and enriching and meaningful in all sorts of other ways, spiritually, in community, in nature, and so forth.
Are you an anti-technologist? I could imagine someone maybe is saying that. It says, well, this is just a...
No, not at all. I just don't... Yeah. I'm just not interested in having it rule everything that goes on in my life. I think we're at an interesting moment right now when we have enough technology to prevent us from having to live, you know, dangerous lives of incredibly brute and endless labor, and that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, we shouldn't use technology to separate us from forever from meaningful contact with other people, from meaningful contact with the natural world. We're at a very lucky moment if only we knew how to take advantage of it. But instead, we end up watching television 6 hours a day on statistical average.
One more caller, line number two. Hello.
Hello. Barbara Ehrenreich, who writes for Mother Jones magazine.
Yeah.
Okay, she wrote a satirical essay a few years back saying, she made the comment sort of half-joking, saying that when people watch TV, what they want is they want to be involved with the people in TV.
That's right.
Who aren't watching TV.
That's right.
That they're doing other things. And so her sort of conclusion was that people watch TV in order to experience sort of a more participatory...
A world where people don't watch TV.
Right. So now the question for people of the left, or you know, who want more participation in social interaction and social policies, is how to get people away from TV and towards, you know, social life.
And it's a difficult question, because what's the advantage of Cheers, the bar where everybody always knows your name and they're always glad you came? I mean, the advantage of it is that it's a risk-free trip to a bar room. It's risk-free participation, because there's no chance that, you know, you're going to sit next to somebody boring or offensive or anything. What we have to figure out ways to do is remind ourselves all the time that it's that risk-free means, in the end, sort of reward-free, you know, that there's a more interesting world out there than the ones that we allow ourselves to lead. And if you never go to an actual barroom or an actual anything and sit and talk with people, well, there's no chance you're going to meet the person you fall in love with, or you become your next best friend, or whatever else. Engagement is such a prerequisite for any sort of political social change, that's what we've really got to work on, to remind ourselves that there's an awful lot of real life out there.
Well, there is a good point for us to end. Well, I want to thank you, Bill, very much
for talking
with us. Our guest this morning, Bill McKibben. If you would like to read his new book, it's entitled The Age of Missing Information, and it's published by Random House.